Welcome to Two Bards, One Mic. Insert interesting music here.
I swear we're actually going to get music one of these days.
Nah.
256.
256.
We're no longer EGA bards.
That's right.
Yeah, upgraded. Got us Matrox. I don't remember any of the Matrox line. Anyway, we'll be playing Monkey Island in full color mode. Thank you very much.
Yes, we will.
Yeah. How's it going, Scott?
It's going pretty good. How about you, Andy?
How's it going, Scott? It's going. Yeah. How was your weeks?
I think they were okay. Let me pull up my brain. So much and so little has been going on. Yeah, there was a Super Bowl in which I didn't care about the outcome. But I was happy with the outcome because fuck the 49ers. Don't think I really had all that much else going on. Yesterday I had my teeth whitened.
Oh, my. How'd that go?
It was interesting. They're not bleaching anymore. They put this stuff on you, and then they use this light that kind of, they say, heats up the gel. You have to put on red glasses, so it might work at like a molecular type level. Yeah. But basically what it does is it softens the enamel and opens the pores on your teeth so that the cleaning agent, it's basically a hydrogen peroxide, can go in there and bubble things off.
Got it.
I think I moved, I mean, I don't know what the bottom end of the scale is, but they have like, I don't know, 24 little teeth, if you will, of various colors from what they believe the lightest they can achieve to the darkest. And you hold it up and say, where do you think your teeth fit? And so I was like at a 12 and I think I got to a 6. So.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's impressive.
Yeah, but it goes up to like 50 something.
Oh, okay.
So I was already,
so they were already pretty white. Yeah.
According to that, otherwise you're bleaching. Right. So, not sure that I'm going to get into the bleaching thing, but
no, that it looks so unnatural. It looks like you're wearing dentures, man.
Yeah.
It's freaky looking.
So this is what it's going to be, and that's great.
Cool. That's very cool.
Yeah, except I can't have anything but water for 24 to 48 hours. Although it did force me to go to Fred Meyer's because I could eat white things. I found the only loaf of keto bread anywhere. I scoured that store for 10 minutes. I was pissed, and I walked by the hamburger bun section, and there's an errant loaf of it. And I was like, okay, I don't know where it's supposed to be, but it's in my hand now.
So we usually find it near produce, of all things. No idea why, but they have a display near produce.
Is it in the, like, the natural section?
I mean, literally, ours is, you know, and not all Fred Meyers are laid out the same, but they're pretty close. Ours is, like, so if we walk into the, I guess, east entrance of the Fred Meyer, we walk right into clothing on the left, produce on the right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it is almost directly in front of us. So it's like by one of the, it's on a little end cap near, I want to say citrus fruits and apples.
Hmm.
So that's where we found it.
Okay.
Yeah. Why would you put it near bread? That'd be stupid. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Shit.
Well, I went to the natural section and they had, you know, the gluten-free and the buckwheat and all this. And I was like, okay, great, it'll be here. And I'm looking and there's nothing. And then I couldn't find the bread section because it's not up against a wall. It's in an actual aisle.
Yeah, what the fuck?
So went to the aisle, found it. Yeah, but anyway, got it, toasted it, made a chicken and white cheddar cheese sandwich. It was amazing.
That bread, well, what kills me is it's zero net carb. It's not one net carb. It's not four net carb like the wraps are. It is zero net carb. It is a giant like slice of fiber, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And it tastes just like white bread. It gets a little like crumblier when you toast it and stuff, but for the most part, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's a little nuttier because you're using almond, I think. But yeah, it was quite delicious.
Yeah, and it's Dave's, right? Or is it just
Franz?
Franz, that's right. Franz Keto. Dave's is the other weird end cap bread that happens to be in the produce section for no reason. So
yeah, and that's the one that I assumed would put out a keto one. I didn't think Franz would, but that's awesome.
Yeah, well, if you ever want to go down a blue link hole, where you just go look up Dave's Killer Bread on Wikipedia and just enjoy your afternoon, because it gets weird, like real weird.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's not owned by the same guy anymore. Basically, is what I'm getting at. So their choices are changing, probably. A bit, so you know, but yeah, if you ever want a fun afternoon, not really fun, an interesting afternoon, go ahead and click down that.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, and I started going to the gym again this week.
Oh, nice.
So yeah, nice. I'm gonna do Monday, Wednesday, Friday for a while just to kind of get back in and not kill myself like I did the last times that I started up again.
Yeah. It's really cool. So yeah, my weeks were pretty banal. I did a little bit of like just planning and stuff like that for some upcoming projects. I still am NDA'd on one of them, so I can't really talk about it. Work has been work, as it always is. Today is the 7th anniversary of our Gamers The Hands of Fate pickup shoot, by the way.
Ah.
Where Brian was wearing the terrible, terrible wig, and you were playing Morpheus, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, One Drive reminded me that this was the 7th anniversary of that. So, the last few days, like today was the day that... 7 years ago that Christian did the Firefly tribute song to Ninja Dragon Riders.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we did the, like I said, the Morpheus scene with the card matrix section and all that jazz. And then a few days ago was the anniversary of the actual Ninja Dragon Riders and Chibi-chan, snuff film that we shot. I mean, it felt like it. It really felt like it.
Mm-hmm.
It was we read a creepy ass elevator, and Matt Vansell is in a Chibi-chan costume, hunched in the corner, and Christian's looming over him. It was eerie, and I imagine people who walked by, because this was when we were still at Inscape.
Yeah.
You know, when people walked by, it was probably like, what the fuck are these guys doing? Should I call the cops? So, yeah, lots of fun there. Trying to think of anything else of note I did. I went to trivia with Ian on Friday, and we won and then retroactively got placed second because one of the other team members went up and whined to them about one of their answers, I guess. So we ended up getting bumped back down, but it was a lot of fun to, it's, you don't go to win, you go to play.
Yeah.
So, tons of fun. Yeah, that's about, we went to a housewarming last night. I won't say where, because I'm going to say who. So it was our friends Jason and Rebecca. Jason runs a pretty successful YouTube channel called Metal Jesus Rocks.
Mm.
So we went and hung out there for a bit and got to see like Cody and Kelsey from Pink Gorilla, who we often see when we're doing ECCC, because they have a booth that tends to be very close to ours. So it was cool hanging out with folks and playing a little bit of Forza Horizon 4. That was a lot of fun, too. So, oh, he also took us on a tour of his big box PC room, and you would have loved this, Scott, because it's all PC games. So he worked at Sierra in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. So, you know, like Space Quest and Police Quest and all that stuff. He's got big boxes of all those. But he also has the gold, like Dungeons and Dragons games, the old TSR.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, all in gold boxes. One of them is worth like $1,000. So, yeah, he let Erin hold it, and she was like, no, I'm not holding $1,000 game, thank you. It was pretty fun. Other than that, though, lots of auditions, no bookings. So, yep. You know, par for the course. Though I have noticed that the beginning of the year is definitely when I get more work for some reason. So I'm keeping them crossed. I've got one more audition I'm doing today. And it's for cartoony voices, so I think I've got that one nailed.
Good.
Yeah, apart from talking about the weather, there's not much else to talk about. Wind, rain, sun, it is very undecisive right now.
Yes, so, it is.
Yeah. And I heard that there was like snow a couple nights ago, too. I didn't see any, but... I heard that Seattle got a little bit.
Yeah, there was snow during the day.
Oh, during the day, okay.
For sure mixed in with what I was doing with the dog, so yeah.
Cool. Haven't really seen my... Oh, because we like to talk about like fun shows and stuff, I will say that I started watching... Harley Quinn, which is on the DC, I don't remember, it's always like what, Plus, Prime, Now, Go, so it's whatever DC's Plus, Prime, Now, Go thing is. I have a shared account, let's call it, with a friend of mine who lives in Idaho, so I've been watching Harley Quinn, and it's fantastic. I don't know if it's new subscription fantastic, but if you can get 7 days, wait until the season's over, get your free 7 days, watch it, and then cancel. It's pretty great.
Very animated.
Fun. It's animated. Mm-hmm. It's rated R animated, so be prepared there. It's not for the kids. Well, maybe it's for the kids. It'd be for my kids. I don't give a shit. They know I love them, so yeah. Basically, you know, lots of F-bombs. It's got Tony Hale in it. If you were into Arrested Development, Tony Hale's done a bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Tony Hale actually played Veep. The Joker in something too. Veep. There you go. Yep. And he is just excellent. It's lots of Alan Tudyk. Alan Tudyk everywhere.
Hmm.
Kelly Cuoco from Big Bang Theory plays Harley. Lake Bell, who is a very, very, very versatile and well, seasoned voice actor, plays Poison Ivy. And then there are a few. Oh, Ron Funches is in it, because of course Ron. So from a certain point of view, you could say that this is sort of making up for Powerless getting canceled, because it's got a ton of Powerless actors in it. No Danny Pudi yet, and Wendy, I forget her real name. None of those folks yet, but. You know, you got your Alan Tudyk and your Funches and various and sundry folks popping up here and there. But, yeah, it's really funny. It's really funny.
Nice.
And that's, I think that's about the only thing I've watched. I did have a fun little tech moment again.
Mm-hmm.
Well, two of them, actually, this week. So I've got a little bit of a rant stored up here. The first was Wave. My internet kept going out like over the last 3 days. Well, I guess, like Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of this week, my internet just kept going out constantly. So I couldn't make any calls because I don't have cell service out here that's reliable. So I have to, go into town basically to make any calls. So I drove to the Wave building mm-hmm. because there's a wave building, and I know where it is, and I just drove there, and they couldn't help me because I'm on business. So basically, I feel like I'm paying more to be helped less because I can only be helped through a call center that handles business accounts. And the thing is, I'm on the same circuit as residential. The only thing is, the only way to get a static IP is to use the business account. So I might just give up on static IPs. We're not really, I mean, apart from some of our redirects, we're not hosting a ton on my NAS. So,
right.
You know, it was ridiculous to pay that much more and get like just orders of magnitude worse service.
Mm-hmm.
Like it was insane. Anyway, it came back up and it's fine now. When it came back up, my Mac popped an update because it had internet connection finally. And it was like, hey, you need to update to Catalina. And I was like, okay. And I updated to Catalina and it completely fried the wireless card. Like it was unrecoverable. Just unrecoverable. So, the Apple folks were like, oh yeah, you could bring it in. It's out of warranty. I was like, well, duh, it's out of warranty. I bought it used. It's like, so it's $100 service charge to take a look at it. And I was like, okay. And they're like, yeah. And if we have to replace the card, it'll be about $500 total. And I'm like, well, you can go fuck yourself. And I am done with your shitty ecosystem. Goodbye. So, I tweeted them and also got a response back like, oh, we want to make this right. Please call us. And I'm or please, you know, talk to us. And I'm like, I already fucking talked to you. Goodbye. We're done. Mm-hmm. I'm done with Apple. If I have a client who has Apple, I'm going to tell them to fuck off specifically because I am not using Apple anymore for any of my work. I'm done with it.
Mm-hmm.
They're a garbage company who gives zero shits about anything but selling whatever comes out next year. So their planned obsolescence is just driving me nuts.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's my little rants.
Yeah,
well, I guess we should get into. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say I was having issues with speed over here, and I noticed like TV was taking a long time to buffer, and even just doing simple things here were taking way longer. Videos buffering on my phone. I was like, okay, so I came in, did a speed test, paying for gigabit. I was getting 25 megabits.
Oh,
so dude. I don't know what was going on. So I discovered that at night, called them. They're like, yeah, we can't access anything. So call back tomorrow, but it should be fixed in 5 hours. Okay. So the next day, of course, nothing's done. Called again. And they're like, okay, have you done this, this, and this? I said, yes, I've done all of those things. Did you unplug the wire from the back? I'm like, no, I power cycled the modem like 4 times. They're like, disconnect the wire and plug it back in. So I disconnected the WAN wire, plugged it back in, and I started flashing red and green. And he's like, okay, perfect. So now recycle it. I said, okay, so what did you do? He said, oh, I just reset some switches. I'm like, well, what am I supposed to do in the future? Because, you know, this has been going on for a while, and I just finally figured out what it was. He's like, oh, I'd power cycle your modem every 2 weeks. I'm like, okay.
What? Okay.
Well, I can do that as maintenance, but that's really weird. Do you have any newer modems that I could use?
Yeah. No shit.
So yeah, that was exciting, and I'm trying to figure out if I want to get a beefy router to replace this one so that I can actually get it to throw places, or if I should just get, since I don't really do a lot of heavy Wi-Fi, I'm not gaming and stuff, whether I should just get a like $100 home mesh system. And just go that route and plug like one mesh in at the living room, one at the far end of the kitchen or out in the breezeway or whatever. And just, you know, plaster the house that way. I don't know what's the better option.
So I'm kind of the mindset that the Like, I don't know. The better option for me is, well, it's a better option for me because I did it. That is grabbing a Ubiquiti gateway. So that's all wired. There's no wireless on it at all. It's just a gateway that goes from my cable modem to my wired network. And then right now I'm using a Bridge Nighthawk, but I'm actually moving to the Ubiquiti mesh setup myself.
Mm-hmm.
However, there's a caveat here. That's not a cheap mesh system. That's way more than I want to pay, which is why I haven't done it yet. But the reliability on the Ubiquiti stuff has been so good that I think it's worth paying for. Mm. I'm just sick of, you know, like you, I'm sick of dead zones in the house and just unreliable. These consumer grade Wi-Fi products are terrible. They just, I think that there's just been a bug in their buffer forever. Mm-hmm. So the buffer just eventually fills up and stops being able to actually function. Because you have to power cycle Wi-Fi more than literally any other appliance I have.
Yeah.
Both networking and non-networking. Wi-Fi has to be cycled, you know, once a week pretty much. So I'm considering moving over to this stuff because it's essentially enterprise level gear, but mm-hmm. it's made for the home. So, mm-hmm. and I'm loving the router so far, or the gateway so far. It's mm-hmm. been great. So,
yeah, you have a little bit. Well, A, you own your house, so you can
yes.
take the time to wire it however you want. I mean, if I had my druthers, yeah, I'd buy a gateway and I'd just run cable to every port in the house and hardwire everything, but.
Yep.
Yeah, can't do that here.
Right. Right.
So.
I will say this, though. We did. Let me see if I can find the brand real quick. Give me one second. I can't see it from here, but we did get a new X10 style power line system just to get quick internet out to the garage. And they're not perfect, but I'm getting over 100 megabits over it, which I'm used to 10 megabits max on those.
What do you mean by an X10?
So it's just you basically plug in these two like transmitter receiver packs into an outlet anywhere on your electrical grid,
mm-hmm.
and once they're plugged in. So basically they, I guess something keeps them from transmitting over the 240 lines at all. So it'll never leave your personal grid, but basically as long as everything's on the same electrical network, you plug these in and they can transfer Ethernet over the power lines. Right. Which mm-hmm. I'm used to that, but I'm used to like terrible, terrible performance. I think you had one as well.
I have them and they're not the best performance.
Right. Well, the ones I have are really good. They're actually shockingly over, you know, they're well over 10 megabits, which is kind of nice. Because I'm used to 10 megabit being the theoretical cap too, not even the actual cap,
right?
On these things, and it's usually like really dirty, noisy signal, so you can't stream anything over them or anything like that. These ones you actually can. And so I'm really like loving that. Let me see if I can find the brand real quick. Just cause I got them off of Amazon. So you know how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Zyxel, Z-Y-X-E-L.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're, yeah, I mean, it's like $70 for two of them, but they actually work. So, yay.
Yeah, I'm looking right now that they still have the limited time deal and works with Alexa, but mm-hmm. the TP-Link Deco whole home mesh Wi-Fi system.
Mm,
so okay. It covers up to the one now that's on sale for less than $100 covers 4,500 square feet, or I can move up to which I might do because it's normally $300 and now it's down to $157. Mm-hmm. The other one I save $10 on. This one I save $150 on. Does 5,500 square feet, home care support, seamless roaming, adaptive routing, 100 plus devices. So yeah, that might be, and they look a little nicer.
Wow.
So $157 for 5,500 square feet. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that is really good.
And looks like PCNet or CNET, PC World, PC Magazine all rate them pretty dang high.
Nice.
And they do vertical and horizontal, which is good.
Yes. Yeah, that's a, everybody forgets about the verticality of of Wi-Fi. And, you know, basically you kind of have a dome where your strongest signal is on the horizontal. So it's not even, it's like more of an ovoid dome.
Mm-hmm.
And people forget that. That's if it's laying flat. If it's up on the wall, you're doing the opposite where, you know, you're getting a little bit of width, but a lot of height. So, yeah, good point on that. All right. Well, should we get to some questions?
Sure.
Cool. Our Bardic question of the week last week is, the customer is always right is now kind of bullshit. Should we now do away with the concept? Discuss. I love the coffee talk nature of this.
Yep.
What was it? The Holy Roman Empire is neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Discuss. So Rob McLennan writes, I'd be interested in hearing the preconception. I did away with the concept long ago and replaced it with the customer is always right unless they're wrong, which I think is a good, that's a good take on that. I'll go to the wall for a client who has a legitimate complaint. The clients who get their backs up and make demands over imagined slights get imaginary redress. Wow, Rob. Yeah, couldn't have said it better myself, frankly. That is my, that's pretty much exactly my opinion as well. I will fight for a customer tooth and nail if they're getting screwed over. Absolutely. 100%. But a customer who comes in using that standpoint, no, fuck off.
Casey Lee writes, no one is, quote, always right. I have been treated like dirt when dealing with a store. Story time. I was a youth and purchased a broken game system and got major static trying to return it the next day with the receipt. This was a chain store in upstate New York called Ames. Poor customer service killed the chain. However, had I smashed the Sega with a hammer, I would have found them justified. But slogans are kind of silly and never cover the complexity of human interaction. They seem to assume the person you are teaching is verbal brainworm. Sorry. They seem to assume the person you are teaching this verbal brainworm cannot follow more complex policy instructions and has the IQ of a houseplant. So, maybe I am saying all slogans seem geared to be insulting to your intelligence.
I mean, a slogan's about shorthand, right? It's about, like, the customer is always right doesn't really mean the customer is always right. If someone comes in and tries to return, you know, a dead seagull they found on the side of the road, you're not going to honor that. That's, you know, that goes without saying. So I think the shorthand portion of it is still, it's not necessarily a bad thing. And I don't think it implies the intelligence of a houseplant per se. However, I will say that the number of people operating with houseplant intelligence seems to be growing. So mm-hmm. maybe, you know, I don't know. I the situation with the video games game system is very close to my heart because I have had to return a video game system legitimately before. But my mom, whenever she, so once she broke one of my systems because she's an idiot. IQ of a houseplant. And what she did was went to the store, bought a new Super Nintendo, put the old one in the box, and returned it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was her. She broke it. Mm-hmm. She broke it. Okay, so it was her fault. Today, that would go down like this. She would try to do that. They would tell her the serial number does not match the one on the receipt and turn her away. Right? But then what would happen is because of this customer's always right crap, she would complain and complain and complain and Karen her way up to the manager and probably get refunded anyway. So, you know, it's a mixed bag because people who legitimately have issues with products sometimes get the worse end of the stick than the people who just complain and complain and complain and are totally in the wrong. And that's kind of where the question came from, because I feel like people who legitimately have issues are getting hindered and hurt by these people who complain extensively when they know they're wrong. I mean, they know they're wrong.
Yep.
You know, and but they will those people still get rewarded. The people who complain extensively still get rewarded because it's cheaper. It's cheaper to take a, you know, in this case, $300 hit than it is to waste $1,000 in person hours dealing with the person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so Brad McGowan writes, it's the fact that they prey on the service worker because of it. I have a family member that most won't go to dinner with. They complain about everything until they get their meal for free. Oh, geez. Embarrass the service worker, report the worker to the manager, and whatever it takes to get their meal free. Worst thing about it is they have the money to pay for it, or another family member would pay. But no, they just like stiffing the low-wage service worker. It's almost like they enjoy doing it. And that right there, that's the glowing circle it in red crayon thing to me. I think that's terrible. It has changed my view on the customer is always right. Yeah, I got to agree with Brad on that one.
Yep. Thankfully, I don't know people like that anymore.
Not anymore.
Oh, sorry. I just hit the microphone, folks. James Peters writes, okay, this is another long one. I feel that, quote, the customer is always right, quote, is an aphorism best suited to small businesses with a high honest to scumbag ratio. As consumers become more canny and informed of the various legal loopholes of which they can avail themselves, it is no longer a point of good service to go above and beyond for a customer acting in bad faith, because that paints you less as a saint of customer service and more as an easy target. I suspect that a large part of this is the change in demographic regarding chain stores and non-local shopping. It used to be, parenthetical, he says having no knowledge of anything prior to 1993, close parenthetical, that you shopped primarily in your city or other local area and folks would know you. If you wanted to be a dick, folks knew you were a dick. Used to be that you could scam the local coffee shop once and then they were wise to you. Now, a dick can hit 4 or 5 stores of the same type, Starbucks for example, within 5 miles of each other, pulling the same scam all the time. This is lamentable, and folks should be lit on fire because of it. Amen.
Yes, agreed.
World needs more fires.
Well, some places of the world need way less fires, but fewer fires. Fewer. Dougie Sharp writes, the customer might not always be right, but in a customer service focused position, it's more about finding out what they need and providing that to the best of your ability, or providing an alternative if what you can do is not the best fit. I agree with that 100% for the people in the previous paragraph from James that are not on the scumbag side. I think honest customers, yes, 100%. This is more specifically, I think, well, the intent of this was more specifically around the intentional gaming of the system that has become, it's become easier to sort of settle out of court, as it were, than to actually, I guess, separate the wheat from the chaff, how do you pronounce that word?
Chaff?
Yeah. Yeah. Where you have customers who will never, ever, ever be good customers. They will never benefit you as a business. The smaller the business, the more difficult that sort of becomes to weigh. But like, especially with big business, Costco will take anything back because it's just easier. Mm-hmm. It's just easier to do that and to have that like glowing customer service review than it is to find out what's right and what's wrong. And, you know, I also agree from the consumer side of things. I hate anti-consumer businesses like Apple, as we mentioned earlier today. And maybe I could have complained and gotten everything fixed for free. And I would have been in the right there because their update screwed up their hardware. However, it was used. It was secondhand. You're taking your own risk at that point. But it comes down to the fact that, like, their policies are extremely anti-consumer and extremely, the customer isn't right or wrong. The customer just goes through these processes and we determine whether or not to charge them. That's how Apple works.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a less personal, it's a far less personal business model. And because of it, I will never fucking buy an Apple product again. I say now until, you know, some big thing comes along and it's only available on like a fucking iPad. But you know, that to me, they're big enough to make that risk though. They're big enough to say, we don't care if we lose 20% of customers who are scamming us anyway. And, you know, or if we lose 20% of our customers and 10% of them were scamming us and 10% weren't, we were the ones in the wrong. It's still better, mm-hmm. than dealing with that 10% who were scamming us. That's kind of how Apple's big enough to do that.
Yep.
So when you get to small business, it is a little bit harder to deal with. I agree. And a customer service focused position is a loaded statement a bit, because any position where you interact with the customer, whether you're direct service or not, is a customer service focused position, in my opinion. I would say development is a customer service focused position. You're there to service the customer. If you're developing something that doesn't service the customer, what are you even doing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I would say all aspects of business are a customer service focused position. So this is more like, you know, is it worth potentially turning away valid customers with valid complaints to avoid dealing with those dickheads, those scumbags? And I think the smaller your business is, the more that answer is no. You'll deal with the scumbags because you want to retain those, you know, those other people who have legitimate complaints, but who will continue being customers for life if you treat them right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a tough question, and I'm really interested to see everyone's opinions on it. So thanks for writing. I don't have one for next week. Do you have anything, Scott?
Not off the top of my head. Perhaps by the time we're done, we'll have something, though.
Oh, you know what we can ask? This is actually fun. Because they have not happened yet. So we're recording this early Sunday morning. How'd you feel about the Oscars? We can't even talk about it because we don't know yet. But how did you feel about the Oscars? Oh, can you believe that one movie won? Whoa. I don't know. Does it work for you? Works for me.
Yeah. Anybody know what channel they're on?
Nope. I'm not even going to watch them. I always just read the tweets the next day.
Well, okay.
I don't care about acceptance speeches. They're always the fucking same. Oh, thanks, Mom. Thanks, my agent.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So, we've also got some pretty good amount of questions to answer.
Yay!
This week. So we'll start off with Casey Lee's first question for the Bards. People, places, and things seem to be killing a lot of us lately. How do we best avoid nouns?
I guess by verbing them? I don't know. I don't know a good way to avoid nouns. I hate people, so I avoid as many nouns as I can on a daily basis anyway. I know how to avoid nouns.
Okay.
I know how to avoid nouns. Drop the O and stay away from convents.
Oh, there you go. Perfect.
Yep, perfect.
I was going to say make them pronouns, but okay.
Well, no, then you just have to pay them more.
True. Second question. What are the Bard's favorite cephalopods, real or fictional?
Great Pacific octopus, 100%. Best cephalopod out there.
Well, I'm not going to say best, biggest.
They're smart.
Yes. I think my favorite cephalopod would have to be the Nautilus.
See, I was thinking that too, but then I was like, am I saying that because I actually like it, or am I saying it because I like 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and that's the name of the thing? Why am I saying that?
So because I was like, they're a perfect geometrical, mathematical...
Oh, golden ratio, yeah.
Yeah. So that it was coming down to the giant Pacific octopus in that. Although cuttlefish, I can't remember technically if they're cephalopods or not. I know that squid are, but squid are not cuttlefish, and cuttlefish are not squid.
Right, right.
And cuttlefish are pretty awesome, but straight up, I'm going to have to go with the Nautilus, just because they've been around an awful long time.
Yeah. So cephalopod just means head, foot, right? So, like...
Yeah, no body.
No body. So I guess Mike Wazowski would count, too. I'm changing my vote to Mike Wazowski.
There you go.
Yeah. Seth M. Davis writes, do either of you plan... damn it, Seth. Do either of you plan to attend conventions in 2020? If yes, which ones?
No.
We are not invited to any conventions. I will be working the booth at ECCC for Zoe because I'm a nice guy. That's it, unfortunately. If
Why?
You if you want us...
Why?
Because I get to hang out with Brian.
Mm.
You know, Brad and stuff like that. And I like hanging out with those folks. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to get into the convention and see it without dropping my own bills.
True.
That being said, I get about 15 minutes every each of the 3 days. That might be 15 minutes total, the more I think about it, to mm-hmm. go do anything. But I don't know. I like it. I like it. It feels cool to see fans and to, you know, yell at stuff. And I really like, I forget if it's his nephew. I think it's Chris's nephew. I like him a lot. He's a really fun dude. But yeah, if you want us at a con, please contact your local cons and ask for us by name.
Yes.
Because we would love to go, but we can't unless we have at least, obviously, convention attendance and room. Like, we'll even drive to close cons on our own. We are fine with that. We'd
and
love
even
to get
some not-so-close cons.
And even some not-so-close cons. We would love to get travel covered, but we understand if a con can't do that. However, we have to have a room with two beds at the bare minimum, mm-hmm. and some food, green room type food, and obviously attendance needs to be covered. But we will gladly show up to any con that provides that for us that we can reach with it, you know, that we have the ability to travel to.
Yep. And if we don't have the ability to travel and they get us there, we'll go anywhere.
Yep. We'll go anywhere. Yeah, anywhere. Literally anywhere. Like if it's in...
Matt Hunt, if you're listening to the sound of my voice.
I will go to Perth, man. I would love to go to Perth.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I'm next. James Peter says, what is your favorite special effect that you have seen in live theater?
You're going to have a way better catalog to pull from. I know mine right off the bat. That's how small my catalog is.
And what is that?
For 100%, the best special effect I've seen in live theater. Man, my mouth isn't working today. The best special effect I've seen in live theater is the quick change in Shrek the Musical. Hands down. It is amazing. It is like a 20-second quick change from being in like greed. Like it's amazing. For it, basically, they put makeup on Fiona. They redress her. This is all while she's singing, and there's a turnaround so they can do the quick spray on of the makeup and everything. It is fantastic.
I have not seen that one, so.
I mean, quick changes are tough. Quick changes while on stage are insane.
Yeah. Yep. I would have to say that while the tire floating in Cats was pretty awesome back then, I'd have to say the best special effects are two, both from the same show, and that would be Les Mis. Actually, three. So they do the set on a turntable, think record player, and there's a part right at the top when they just set you up for what's going on, and Javert has... Valjean has left prison, and he's singing the song about walking back to town, and he turns and starts walking across the stage while the turntable turns on, so he is walking and not moving anywhere, and bits of the set get set onto the turntable, and he passes by things right there. And that was the first, oh my God. The second was being in the town, in the alleyways, where all the, you know, poor people are hanging out. And it's this amazing alleyway between two tall buildings. Mm-hmm. And then they get to the Revolution and the Rebellion, and those two tall buildings that are perfectly vertical tall buildings get dropped onto their sides and become the barricade in a mishmash of furniture and everything else that is absolutely horizontally a perfect barricade, and they do it right in front of your eyes, and you're just like, how is this happening?
Right.
But that's all design stuff. The one that still baffles me to this day is Javert's Suicide, where the flies are very rare anymore in theater, but they are the rope pulley system that exists above the stage where they can drop things down, have a fly system for Tinkerbell or Peter Pan to go around the stage, Mary Poppins, etc. And they can also use those flies to drop various stage decoration backdrops, etc., etc. Well, from the heavens drops the bridge railing that Javert stands on for his big suicide song. And you see four cables, two railings, one in front, one in back, and he walks between those things. And he is singing. And then he steps over the front one with one leg, over the second one with the other leg. And you're like, oh, he is now standing outside the railing. And then he holds onto the railing, leans forward a little bit, and lets go. And what they do is they fly the bridge up as he's coming slowly and slowly forward. His feet are not planted on the ground. No one has that kind of core strength to defy physics of leaning out over your toes like you're a ski jumper. So he has to have some cable system behind him, but the bridge has just flown up. So the only way I can think of them to do it is that this cable is run under the bridge, up on the side. He attaches it as the bridge goes away. Then the cable goes taut. I don't know. But anyway, despite how the magic happens, he falls forward. The bridge flies out super fast up, so it looks like he's actually falling onto the stage. And then this gobo, which is a patterned light, hits the stage, and it's also multicolored, so it's this blue, turquoise blue and white, and it starts to spin because it's the water that he's falling into, and as he falls and lands, the stage rotates at the same rate the gobo's rotating, so whatever part he falls into in the water, it stays there, and he's just washed off the stage. And it's just mind-boggling. And I've seen it three or four times, and I still look for it, still can't figure out how they do it. Still blows me away. Yeah, it's just ingenious use of very limited resources.
Nice. That sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Dougie Sharp asks, some friends have joined a local theater, so I've been seeing more plays. Should I applaud when they go to intermission? That's his first question.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do live theater on the other side, so I'm always confused about when is appropriate to applaud, but I feel like the cast is going to appreciate applause when they leave stage, whenever that is, provided it's not going to interrupt something else. So I say, yeah, applaud before intermission.
Oh, are we breaking take? This down question by question?
Yeah, yeah, I think so.
I don't want anything that's not earned.
Well, okay, yes. Don't applaud if it's not earned. I'm saying if intermission ends with an applause-worthy situation, yes, applaud.
Yes, usually at the end of the acts,
right,
which usually has house lights coming up, whether that's mm-hmm. the end of the show or end of intermission, it is permissible and encouraged, if you are so moved, to applaud.
Right.
Case in point, Sylvia just opened for Renton Civic on Friday. Jen and I went to opening night. And in between the scenes where all the individual blackouts are, there was no applause. There was applause at intermission, and there was applause at the end. Last night, I went to house manage, and they got applause in every blackout. So it kind of depends upon the house.
Right.
And sometimes if you start something, it will be followed. And sometimes you are an island.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine. Be loud and proud. Voice your opinion with applause.
Right. And this leads perfectly into the next question, because I have a minor gripe about this. Second question. I'm usually in the front row, so it's hard to read the rest of the audience. Understandable. Is it awkward for the performers if the audience doesn't give a standing ovation at the end and just applauds from their seats? Or is it more awkward for just one person to be standing while the others sit? Before November, I hadn't been to a play since Bo's Patriot play during the first ZoeCon. I'm assuming that's
Veterans Day Project.
Veterans Day, yeah. Yep. I don't know the culture. Standing ovations have become too commonplace,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion. A standing ovation should be given for something standing ovation worthy. Otherwise, it's meaningless. And it is becoming more and more of a custom to give standing ovations at any play that is decent. Usually because a lot of the performer's family are in the audience or something like that. You know, and they're, of course, thinking that every performer's family thinks that they stole the show, right? Because they're paying more attention to that performer and stuff like that. It's just human nature. And I'm not saying it's even wrong. It's just the way things are. You bring your family to a performance, they're going to be more into your performance than other people are, usually. Unless you are deserving of a standing ovation, and then probably everybody's looking at you, so it's good. What I've noticed, though, is like if you go to I've been to a few high school plays because, you know, my kids were in school and stuff, and high school plays I think have always kind of been that, like, they give a standing ovation for everything. Also, generally the last show of anything that I've been to gives a standing ovation, whether or not it's deserved. So my take is, do you feel like you need to stand and clap? Like, was it that good of a performance? Then don't worry about the rest of the audience. Just do it. Do you not feel like it deserves a standing ovation? Then don't. The blind adherence to one person stood up, so everybody needs to, should go. The weird move to do a standing ovation at the most mediocre of events needs to go. A standing ovation should be reserved almost like an audience award. It should be given when it is deserved and not given just because the crowd is doing it. I'll tell you from my very, very limited experience on stage, you can see the audience standing, but the lights, this is just my experience. So this has been like, you know, community theater or lower here. So like, you know, school theater or whatever. I'm not thinking about anything but getting my ass off stage so I can take off my makeup, because it's like uncomfortable. The clothes are uncomfortable. I want to get the hell out of there, and I can barely see anything. In the limited number of stage performances I've had, that's how I've always felt. I don't care about the standing ovation. It's nice to hear applause. I'll give you that. It feels good to hear applause. But you know, I don't think that that validation is healthy if it's unearned, personally.
Yeah. So much to unpack here. A, stop sitting in the front row.
No shit. You rich guy.
No, it's I not. Know. It's not even that. Sit five rows back. Sit seven rows back. Sit in the center for sure. But most directors can't block for anything that's 10 feet right off a center. But don't sit in the front row. You can hear them. If you can't, definitely don't applaud. But yeah, don't sit in the front row. You're doing yourself a disservice. I hate. In fact, when we put in the new seats at Renton, we took out, I think, the first two rows so that it forced people to be a little farther back.
Yeah.
You're just not getting a good perspective of anything, and nobody's that hard of hearing. There are almost all theaters have some sort of FM loop. Mm-hmm. So you can, or headsets or whatever. So yeah, if that's an issue, you know, great. There's ways around it. Don't sit in the front.
Well, go watch a rehearsal. Where's the director sitting? That's probably the best seat, you know?
Yeah. When you watch mine, I'm all over the place, but, So to Andy's point, the only awkwardness is yours if you're the only one standing and applauding. So it's basically, are you moved? It's personal. I mean, I have sat while the whole rest of an auditorium erupts in a standing ovation, and I'm like, what did you people see?
Exactly.
And I have stood up and been the only person going absolutely ape shit because of something that I saw. A lot of times, sometimes it's a political thing. I saw some plays at Ashland that, while probably, well, they were well acted as well, but, the concept of the play, the dedication of everyone involved, there was something bigger than just the performance that I was standing for. But then there's other times when, unless it's an ensemble piece and the whole cast comes out, I will stand when somebody worthy of it comes out. Mm-hmm. You know, and if that's, hey, this whole show was great, so the first maid that comes out with the porter, I'm standing. And if I got to wait until it was, you know, the second lead, then that's when I stand. But I don't care what the rest of the auditorium feels. That's how I'm going to react. And like Andy said, they are, I'm lucky. I see a lot of good theater, so I can stand, and I need to sometimes after 2 hours. but as a performer, I do notice when people stand and when they don't. And it's always gratifying to see that. Yes, it's super gratifying if everybody's on their feet. But I'd rather see pockets of people that are standing and know that I really affected those people, and the other people are still applauding. They had a good time. The thing that I think I hate the most is the guilty full standing ovation, mm-hmm, where everybody's been introduced. You have a good portion of people standing. You take your first bow. You're still standing there. And then people are like, okay, I guess I'll stand. And then they stand for that final bow. And it's just like, hey, why'd you even do it? So yeah. Basically, do what you feel you got to do. Stop sitting in the front row. Mm-hmm. That's, I think, answers everything.
Yep. I think that's pretty good.
Rob McLennan writes, what is your horror subgenre preference? Body horror, psychological, jump scare, or no horror at all. Mine is no horror at all. although I will, people will argue with me that Aliens is a horror film, and
Aliens?
Alien is a horror film.
Okay.
And yes, it is. So whatever that is, which I think is a little bit of jump scare, a little bit of psychology, or yeah, psychological, and a little bit of body horror, you know, that type of thing, I don't like seeing. I mean, I have sat through, because when when we did the Demon Hunters orientation training video, Don had me watch The Hills Have Eyes 3 and something else for a character study for Samhell. And I said, okay, I'll watch them. I don't really like to, but like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, no. Centipede, no. All the stuff, Hostel, no. The Purge, no. Yeah, I just don't. I'm still not sure if I'm going to see the Jordan Peele one.
Us? Or?
Yeah.
Probably Us, yeah.
Yeah, I saw the other one, because that wasn't really, that was more like Stepford Wives-y.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to say there's a line, because like, some would argue that Alien was more suspense than anything.
Yeah.
Jaws is more suspense than anything, you know? And I would say that Get Out is 100% a suspense thriller.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the classifications get so blurry, and subgenre-ing things makes it very tough too, because, you know, comedic horror is my favorite horror because it's more comedy usually, you know, Cabin in the Woods is fucking hilarious.
Oh yeah.
Like, it's hilarious. It's legitimate horror in a lot of places, but like when, Whitford sees the fucking mermaid. It's amazing. That is the best moment in that movie to me. It's so good because he saw his mermaid and then it killed him. Like, the whole movie was just so much fun. And there were scares in it. There were jump scares. There were psychological scares. But it was so much fun. One would argue that from the standpoint of the kids, Tucker and Dale actually is a horror movie on one side of it, but it's a comedic horror, right? So I think comedic horror is 100% my favorite kind of horror, because it's almost not. Even going back to like Nightmare on Elm Street, what was it, 4, the Dream Warriors?
Yeah.
Because that's the best one. The first one's actually legitimately kind of spooky. And cheesy as all hell, but kind of spooky. Robert Englund really brought so much comedy to the character, though, and that came out in 4 like no other. I don't care for stalker horror that much. Things like, you know, your Friday the 13th, or everybody gushed about It Follows. It was fine. It was okay. It was fine. I like horror elements in other movies. One of my all-time favorite moments in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is when they're on the helicarrier and Banner turns, because for a very brief section there, it becomes a horror movie. It's a legit monster movie where Banner turns into an actual monster and chases Black Widow. And it's legitimately kind of scary. Mm-hmm. That to me is good. I like when horror augments the storytelling, but in a lot of horror movies, it's literally just, you know, meh. It is fun to watch them rooting for the protagonist, though, or for the antagonist, though. So, like, if you go into a horror movie and you're like, yeah, Jason, get him, it makes it a lot less scary. Like, you don't get that. Like, it even neutralizes jump scares a little bit. And all of a sudden, you're just, it's an underdog movie where the plucky go-getter, you know, makes it.
Yeah.
They did it. They did it. But, yeah, most horror movies are, I'm just going to, like, say it. They're not exciting. They're just fucking slow. The Conjuring, that stupid Annabelle, they're so slow. They're just, cause they're trying to build tension, but you know exactly where everything's going. So you're like, just get there, either get there or go somewhere else, you know? And they tend to not do either. They just plod along.
Yep.
Casey Lee asks, semantic question for the bards. Is baby powder a spice?
Not culinary.
No. What is it? It's primarily talc, right? Or, and if it's not, it's cornstarch. Neither are spices, technically.
Mm-hmm.
Talc's a mineral, so if you consider salt a spice, maybe. And then of course cornstarch is not a spice. It's a
absorbing thickener.
Thickener. That's what it was. Thickening agent. So unless you're talking about grinding up babies, in which case also no. At that point it would be more of a
accoutrement.
Accoutrement, yeah. It would be parsley, you know, in that case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or I guess maybe more like parmesan. So whatever the next step up from condiment is in terms of culinary snootitude.
Yes.
So besides, if baby powder was a spice, you know, the Spice Girls have baby spice. So I guess if she ever dehydrates, she's technically a spice still.
Yeah. I'd give you that.
Yeah.
Dehydrated baby spice.
Indeed. All right. Well, that wraps it up for this week.
You betcha.
Huge, huge thanks to our Patreon patrons. You take it this time.
Okay. Hawk Robinson.
James Peters.
Leslie Sedlak.
Rob McLennan.
Stuart Hume.
Zombie Orpheus Entertainment.
Gordon D. Duke.
Denise Nickel.
Jay Blinken.
Casey Lee.
Dougie Sharp.
Laura Red Scott.
Seth M. Davis.
Todd McKimmy.
Lotta Jerf.
Tom Brophy.
Laura Adams.
James Herbert.
Beau Pritchard.
Tim Martin.
Brad Roberts.
Jennifer Reifenberry.
And Rival Guy.
That guy. Songs about him, you know?
Mm-hmm.
What a lover, not a rival.